This week, a UN resolution for getting humanitarian aid into Gaza comes amid warnings of mass starvation risk.
2.2 million people remain trapped, with 9 out of every 10 spending entire days without food.
Families of hostages still being held by Hamas plead for international leaders to help free their loved ones.
We need you to help us to get them home back now. We can't leave them there.
And a major shift in the Vatican's policy for same-sex couples as Pope Francis tells Holy See hierarchy to avoid rigid ideological positions. Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
A humanitarian ceasefire is the only way to begin to meet the desperate needs of people in Gaza and end their ongoing nightmare.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Friday that the way Israel is conducting its military operation in the Gaza Strip is, quote, creating massive obstacles to the distribution of humanitarian aid inside the Palestinian enclave of 2.3 million people.
We waited 71 days for Israel finally to allow aid to enter Gaza via the Kerem Shalom crossing. And the crossing was then hit while 8 trucks were in the area. The humanitarian operation requires staff who can live and work in safety. 136 of our colleagues in Gaza have been killed in 75 days, something we have never seen in the history of the United Nations. Nowhere is safe in Gaza.
Minutes before his presser, the Security Council adopted a watered-down resolution Friday calling for immediately speeding up aid deliveries to desperate civilians in Gaza, but without the original call for an urgent suspension of hostilities. The vote in the 15-member council was 13-0, with the United States and Russia abstaining.
Shelves are empty, wallets are empty, stomachs are empty.
Friday's vote came after a week of delays and intense negotiations to avoid a veto by the United States. United Nations and other agencies reported this week that more than 1 million people in Gaza, half the population, are starving, while warning of the risk of famine.
2.2 million people remain trapped, with 9 out of every 10 spending entire days without food. Gazans are experiencing unprecedented levels of starvation and thirst, while doctors lack even the most basic of medical supplies to treat the wounded and the growing threat of infection.
United Arab Emirates Deputy UN Ambassador Mohammed Abu Shahad, Israel's campaign to eradicate the EU and U.S. designated terror group Hamas has left the coastal enclave of Gaza in ruins, brought widespread homelessness, and killed nearly 20,000 Gazans. Israeli forces widened their offensive in Gaza on Friday in an escalation described as one of the most intense onslaughts of the war. I spoke with John Linden, executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, who has expressed concerns that Israel would escalate the bombardment before winding down its operational goal of eliminating the Hamas threat.
But it remains to be seen whether those goals set out at the start of this campaign are achievable within a few weeks. And one of my worries is if Israel feels that that clock is ticking, they may be incentivized to actually increase the intensity of the operation in order to try and inflict the maximum damage before the stopwatch goes. And I think that would be a grave mistake as well.
More people would get killed, but also would that potentially put the people that are still being held hostage by Hamas at risk?
Yes. I mean, you're hearing this from hostage families as well. There's a lot of anger, I think, increasingly over the consequence of this for hostages. I mean, obviously, the intensity of the bombing, and we've had reports of bodies recovered of hostages, but also reports that tunnels are being flooded with seawater, which, in addition to damaging the water table in the Gaza Strip, I mean, it's hard to be sure that that won't also result in the loss of life for hostages. And I spoke to one hostage family that was really worried about that. And then there's the public health issue as well. I mean, hostages are consuming the same food and water as they're the people holding them captive. They're in the same physical environment. They will also be susceptible to the same diseases. So the worse the humanitarian crisis gets in Gaza, and to be clear, we should be very concerned acutely about how that's affecting Palestinians, but it's naive not to also understand that that will also put the lives of Israeli hostages in jeopardy as well.
You said there's about 2 million people in Gaza. Is it fair to say that about 100 million of them, or half of them, are children?
Yeah, the median age in Gaza is 17, right? So that means the majority of people who live in the Gaza Strip are under 18, so are minors or children. And that's why you see such a disproportionate number of the casualties being reported being children. I spent quite a bit of time there, and it's utterly unlike the West Bank, which is more sparsely populated and has a higher median age as well. It reminds me of time I spent in India, where you just see a lot of small children in narrow alleyways, very densely populated, you know, and it's impossible to imagine a military operation at this level where children aren't going to be the primary victims of it. And in addition to the terrible sort of fallout and loss of life for young Palestinians, there's a number of children who are being injured and maimed as well, with very little hospital capacity to be able to deal with it. We're seeing a huge increase in the number of amputations that wouldn't necessarily have to be amputations if there was access to proper hospital facilities. So that's going to have decades of legacy for those young people growing up in Gaza. And then the final part of it is the trauma. And if you just imagine, if you're, you know, somebody 10, 15 years old, and this is obviously going to be the most traumatic and scarring experience of your life, and it's going to radically affect what you think for the rest of your life. It's human nature. And I do worry that we are storing up decades more of resentment and hate from young people in the Gaza Strip, which ultimately are part of the security dynamic that Israel should be taking into account. And I think we really need to give those young people, particularly in the aftermath of this war, something to hope for and believe in. Because you could just imagine if the physical environment is destroyed, they've lost family members, and then there's no horizon, there's no clearer option being provided. Exactly. Like, I mean, it's just a pit of despair. And, you know, on a human level, it's awful, but on a cold national security calculation from the perspective of Israel, that is a terrible legacy to be bestowing for the future. And, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, but these are exactly the kind of environments that very scary organizations emerge from. And you would worry that even by destroying Hamas, if you leave behind this traumatized, scared and angry population, something even worse could emerge afterwards.
John Linden, Executive Director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace. Meanwhile, families of the hostages still being held in Gaza say time is running out to save their loved ones as they beg the international community for help.
Help us bring their loved ones home. We don't have a single moment to lose anymore.
At a meeting with dozens of foreign diplomats at a central public library in Tel Aviv this week, the families of Hamas hostages pleaded for help in releasing their loved ones from captivity.
I'm the sister of Alex Lobanov. Alex is 22 years old. Alex have a 2 years old son that every day keep asking where is daddy.
My kid? I don't want him in a bag. I still have hope. But that hope each day that passes by, much more difficult. So I ask you, I plead, I beg, please, when you leave this ceremony, go back to your office, get on a call, talk to your people, let this thing end.
240 people were taken hostage during the October 7th attack by Hamas. Israel says 129 people are still being held, but 21 are believed to be dead. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to confirm recently that new Qatar-mediated negotiations were underway to recover hostages being held in Gaza, after a source said Israel's lead negotiator met with Qatar's prime minister. News of a new round of negotiations came after Israel's military disclosed that troops had accidentally killed 3 hostages who approached them with a white flag after having escaped their captors in Gaza last Friday. A previous humanitarian truce collapsed on December 1st after Hamas released 110 Israeli and other international hostages in exchange for dozens of Palestinian prisoners in Israel.
8 of my family members were released. They have returned, but they are not whole. Far from it. After over 50 days, we finally know where 3-year-old Yahel is sleeping at night. But Yahel doesn't know where her father is sleeping, though sadly, she knows what he's going through. She's a 3-year-old who knows what being held hostage in Gaza is like.
When asked by reporters, Netanyahu refused to discuss details of any potential hostage release negotiations. The The Ukrainian capital of Kyiv was attacked by a barrage of Russian drones early Friday morning in what marked the sixth drone attack on the city this month. Ukraine attempted to break through the lines of invading Russian forces in 2023. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, neither side appears to be able to make a significant breakthrough as U.S. lawmakers broke for the holidays this week without reaching a deal on sending billions in critically needed military aid to Ukraine.
Invading Russian forces seized the Ukrainian salt mining town of Soledar in January 2023 after months of brutal fighting. Russian missiles continued to rain down on Ukrainian cities. With Ukrainian forces struggling to make battlefield gains, Western allies announced they would send heavy weapons to Kyiv, including tanks and longer-range missile systems. Ahead of the first anniversary of the war in February, US President Joe Biden made an unannounced visit to Kyiv. He said Russian President Vladimir Putin had been wrong about Western commitment to Ukraine.
He thought he could outlast us. I don't think he's thinking that right now.
Evidence suggests that Russia destroyed the Novokakhovka Dam in May, flooding vast areas of southeast Ukraine to stall any Ukrainian counteroffensive and creating an environmental disaster. Russia, in return, blamed Ukraine for the structure's collapse. By June, Ukraine was able to recapture some territory, but failed to achieve a major breakthrough in the Russian lines. The Western weapon supplies were too little, too late, says analyst Ian Bond.
The Russians had a long time to build up their minefields and their fixed fortifications. So they're actually in a much stronger position than they were. And we've been asking the Ukrainians to launch their counteroffensive when they have very little air capability.
Mercenaries from Russia's private Wagner army staged a mutiny in June. Putin negotiated an end to the rebellion. Wagner's chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was killed in a plane crash a few weeks later. By November, Ukraine's commander-in-chief said the war had reached a stalemate, though Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, disagreed with his assessment. Zelensky did achieve a diplomatic breakthrough, as the European Union in December agreed to start formal accession talks.
The negotiation process will not be easy, but the main thing is that historically we have made a determination. Ukraine will always be part of our common European home.
But that European future remains in the balance, says analyst Olga Tokariuk.
If Ukraine is defeated, if Ukraine fails militarily, all the, you know, EU membership negotiations process is worthless. But it will not just be a defeat of Ukraine. It will be a defeat of European Union and the wider West that committed to supporting Ukraine as long as it takes.
Ukrainian forces face a long, bitter winter on the front lines, with vital military aid packages held up in both the United States and the European Union. Analysts say Ukraine's greatest concern for the coming year is Western fatigue, as the US presidential election looms at the end of 2024. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And as Russia's war on Ukraine drags on, the humanitarian impacts are of increasing concern.
These needs will be long-term, and these needs, particularly mental health, will be for many generations.
This week, the World Health Organization issued a dire warning that Ukraine's health system will come under enormous stress and put millions of civilians at risk of increased illness during the long, brutally cold winter ahead.
And we have witnessed increased number of burns related to heating and the new heating devices, because since the attacks to the civilian infrastructure, people need to find ways to have electricity and heating.
Yarno Habich, WHO representative in Odessa, Ukraine, says the public health impacts have continued to worsen since the February 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Pope Francis on Thursday used his annual Christmas greeting to the Holy See hierarchy to encourage the cardinals, bishops, and laypeople who run the Vatican to avoid rigid ideological positions that prevent them from understanding today's reality and encourage them to listen to one another and to others so that they can evolve to truly offer service to the Catholic Church. The appeal was made days after a decision by Francis that formally allowed Roman Catholic priests to bless same-sex couples, as long as they're not part of regular church rituals or liturgies. Christy Kilburn with Reuters reports.
It marked another significant change made by the Pope in his effort to make the Roman Catholic Church more welcoming. But the new rule made clear that such blessings can only be administered on a case-by-case basis. It also said that it should in no way be confused with the sacrament of heterosexual marriage. Outside St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, Martin Hardwick and his partner Andrew Gibb welcomed the news.
You know, if Jesus said love was love, then love is love, isn't it? We've been together 41 years. So, and we're married.
So, It's about time, long overdue.
Yeah.
In Pope Francis's hometown of Buenos Aires, some residents saw the ruling as a measure to fight discrimination.
It is a paradigm shift for the church, and the inclusion of same-sex couples is a change for the church. As Argentinians, we feel proud that the Pope has taken this initiative, because in our country, there are laws that have been accompanying this process of transformation for several years.
Monday's ruling is bound to be opposed by conservatives, who already criticized the Pope when he hinted that an official change was in the works in October, in response to questions put forward by five conservative cardinals.
Christy Kilburn with Reuters reporting. And for a deeper dive, I spoke with Julie Byrne, chair and professor at Hofstra University's Department of Religion, for insight into the significance of this change of Vatican policy.
From as few as 2 years ago, when the same Vatican office famously, infamously said, God cannot bless sin, in reference to such a proposal. And now, with the leadership of that office changed over, Pope Francis has led this new change in that really is just a total reversal. It is, yes, not a sanctioning of same-sex marriage, not a change in the definition of the sacrament of marriage, which for the Catholic Church remains between a man and a woman. However, for there to be the potential for blessing a same-sex union means to me that it is a step towards saying this is not sin. This is a union. This is a loving couple that might have a family, that might have friends, that might have allies, all Catholics potentially, who are now going to be feeling more welcome in that space, in the space of the Catholic Church.
This is a Pope that is looking for the church to evolve, but Catholic teaching says that marriage is lifelong union between a man and a woman. What's the difference?
Well, I think that though Francis is definitely encouraging evolution, changing with the times, being more responsive to contemporary realities, at the same time, he, I think, wants to be careful. And I think that this is maybe one thing that progressives and conservatives in the church share, is that they seem to be consistent with past statements as well, that there is a continuity and not a, you know, radical departure at any particular juncture of church teaching. And so officially, the definition of same-sex sexuality as, quote, intrinsically disordered is still on the books. And that hasn't been officially overturned. Instead, there has been this different track toward hospitality, welcome, blessing. Blessings in the Catholic Church are used for a huge variety of things. You can ask a priest to come to your home and bless a new house, or you can ask a priest to bless your pets. There's often at many churches, you know, on St. Francis of Assisi Day, a blessing of the pets. Or if someone who's non-Catholic goes up for communion, they can't take communion in the Roman Church, but they can ask for a blessing. So there's ways in which blessing just serves to say on many occasions, this is good and we want to make it better. There's people here who are asking for God's grace to come into their lives in some way, and we don't want to stand in the way of that. And so it's not, strictly speaking, overturning the position on same-sex sexuality, but it is trying to say there's blessing, grace, mercy, the avenues of God's love open to many people, and to say explicitly in this case that pertains to same-sex couples. It's also really interesting that the, quote, irregular couples were also included in this pronouncement, and by that, the Roman Church means Catholics who were divorced and are now remarried. They too are now eligible for blessings from priests is maybe as much a change and as significant because of the reams and reams, not only of same-sex Catholic couples, but also divorced and remarried Catholic couples who previously, if they had not annulled their previous marriage, were considered to be having sex outside of marriage in an adulterous relationship in their remarriage. Now, there seems to be that extension of grace to divorced and remarried Catholics who are obviously going on with their lives and living in loving relationship and with families and struggles and all the same, they too can ask the priest to bless their new union.
There are about a billion or more Catholics worldwide and the largest Christian denomination in the world. Many of them are living in countries, particularly some in Africa, that have really harsh, even death penalty consequences for people, even that are just gay, not even necessarily going as far as marriage. Some African activists have praised Francis's decision and hope that the gesture could ease some anti-LGBTQI sentiment and oppression in the continent. But whether or not that happens is debatable. There are African religious organizations that are not happy. If some of those countries that are predominantly Catholic, do you see this possibly having any impact?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought of it from that angle, that the influence of the church, Pope Francis speaking this note of hospitality and welcome and acceptance of same-sex sexuality and coupledom might have an influence. I think it could. The church is very influential where it is followed piously. And so I think that that's a possibility. I don't think it's an immediate likelihood. And I also think that that's why this pronouncement is worded as an option, that priests have an option. And it's, as far as I can tell, take it or leave it for any particular priest and probably really for the tone of any particular diocese around the world, which is, you know, the different Catholic administrative units. And I would say even further that, you know, most of the world is more socially conservative on the idea of same-sex acceptance than Western Europe and the United States. And, you know, in the United States, there's, you know, currently a lot of pushback about trans rights. And so not even in the United States, right? All over the world, it's still a contested issue. But I would say that the Pope, with this note of welcome, is doing a couple of things. He's definitely, you know, trying to encourage acceptance in new directions, specifically of same-sex sexuality, since there has been real pointed lobbying by LGBTIQ communities that are Catholic in both the United States and Western Europe. But he's also doing something very practical, which is that these are the places where the church's money comes from. and it's also the places where the risk of losing young people is drastic, that, you know, Western Europe is rapidly de-churchifying, especially in the younger generations. And that goes for the United States as well, with young people frequently choosing not to be affiliated with the church of their parents, affiliate with no religion at all. And what's often cited is what they see as hypocrisy about, you know, love everyone and then have anti-gay policies, which hurts them and hurts their friends. And so I really think that, you know, Francis is being very practical here too. It, doesn't speak to the global church. Much of the global church has really different priorities than LGBTIQ rights. And I want all of those places eventually to, you know, change their policies, as you suggested might happen with this. But they have other priorities like poverty and women's rights and, you know, children's health. So I think that really this is directed toward the United States and Western Europe, where there has been, you know, steps towards acceptance and the loss of young Catholics that Francis is partially wanting to address.
Julie Byrne, chair and professor at Hofstra University's Department of Religion. And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London, wishing you a joyful holiday season.